Hello, and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with baseball writers and authors, artists and musicians, filmmakers, basically anyone who has anything to do with baseball and pop culture. Because that's our slogan. If it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Well, welcome to this new version of the Baseball Bookshelf podcast. I've relocated since last doing these things. No longer am I surrounded by animals, including the birds who keep me company and entertain you, no doubt. Now I'm working out of the basement with a different computer, a different version of GarageBand that doesn't allow me some of the old clips I might have used. You may have noticed a new introduction. Well, that's my attempt to take me out to the ballgame on the ukulele with a little effects thrown in for fun. So this is what it's going to be for now. Hope you enjoy it. Please let me know. Drop me a line at ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf@gmail.com with your suggestions on who you might like to have on as a guest, who you might like to listen to hear talk about their life in baseball. So now, on with the show. My wife's a veterinarian, and when our daughter was about 2 years old, she had a job interview in Cooperstown. We all went along for the nice little trip, and while my wife was having her interview, my daughter and I sat outside and just enjoyed being in the surroundings. I've always loved the quiet little town nestled in the mountains of upstate New York, but then we had only visited in good weather. As you may have guessed, my wife didn't accept the job, so I can only wonder if that could have been me, the Jewish mayor of Cooperstown, whose last name begins with K.A. and who writes about baseball. In 2007, Jeff Katz published his first baseball book, The Kansas City A's and the Wrong Half of the Yankees, How the Yankees Controlled Two of the Eight American League Franchises During the 1950s. This year, he's published the well-received Split Season 1981, Fernando Mania, The Bronx Zoo, and The Strike That Saved Baseball. I had the opportunity to speak with his honor before his upcoming visit to the Bergino Baseball Clubhouse in Manhattan on Wednesday, May 20th.
Mayor Jeff Katz, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
It's a pleasure to be on with you, Ron. Thank you.
So how old were you in 1981?
I was 18 going on 19. I turned 19 in September.
What do you recall about the strike of 81, and what were your feelings at the time?
Well, I was always a huge baseball fan. Way before I was 18, I grew up in Brooklyn and Long Island, so I was always a passionate baseball fan. 1981 was no exception. It was just odd, you know, to have baseball pulled from the middle of my summer. Like all of us, we were shocked, and I was shocked. And I can't really recall how I scrambled to fill my time, but there was a clear void, and that void always stuck with me to the point where I felt I needed to write a book about it.
Well, where did you grow up at that time? Were you in Cooperstown at that point?
No, I didn't move to Cooperstown till 2003. At that time, we had recently moved from Long Island to Staten Island. So I was a bit closer, ironically, you know, I was a bit closer to Shea and to Yankee Stadium. It was our first summer there. I was kind of poised to go to more games, and there were no more games to go to.
So what was this strike about?
The strike was really the owner's attempt to kill free agency. Free agency had been granted to the players in December of 1975 through an arbitrator's decision, and much to the shock, really, of everyone, players and fans alike, the amount of money that the owner started throwing at players was beyond comprehension. Now it seems like small change, but then, you know, people signing multiple $100,000 a year contracts was huge.
It seems almost quaint to think of that type of money now.
Oh, I know. You know, at the end of 79, Nolan Ryan became the first $1 million a year player. I remember, like, oh my God, million a year. Now the average salary is like $4 million or something.
Right.
So the owners, you know, then like now, had a hard time controlling themselves. I mean, the players can make demands, but the players can't write themselves checks. So the owners were looking for ways to kill free agency. before the 1980 season, there was almost a strike, and the issue was how to compensate teams that lost free agents. The owner's big idea was called direct compensation. If a team lost a free agent, then that team would be able to pick a quality major league player from the roster of the team that signed the free agent, in effect making it a trade. And while that might not have affected the Nolan Ryan signings or the Dave Winfield signings, not everyone was of that caliber. So if all of a sudden you wanted to sign a player, but it meant you lost maybe your third best starting pitcher, because he was the 16th best player on your roster, that's the owners were going to allow every team to freeze 15 players. All of a sudden it might change how you viewed signing free agents, which would kill movement of players from team to team, crush salaries, and in 1981, the first year of the Reagan presidency, the only place trickle-down economics worked was in baseball, because the free agent salaries at the top infiltrated the entire salary structure. Owners sought to kill that, players fought to preserve it.
Now, can you give me a brief description of the main cast of characters in this business?
On the negotiating side, there's three main figures. Marvin Miller was the executive director of the Players Association, had been there since 1966. And as Miller said, when you enter an industry that's 100 years behind the times, it's easy to make big strides forward. And that's what had been happening since 66. The players kept advancing their rights, and by advancing their rights, increasing their salaries. On the owner's side, you have a man named Ray Grebe, who was brought in 1978 as a way for the owners to hopefully professionalize their side of the labor negotiations. They felt that they were at a disadvantage to Miller because Miller came from U.S. Steel and real labor negotiations, and the owners never had someone like that. Grebe came from General Electric, which was known for hardline negotiations and somewhat of a union-busting attempt. So they brought him in. And then lurking both on the periphery and in the middle is Commissioner Bowie Kuhn. Really somewhat of a tragic figure. I don't want to get too sympathetic for Bowie Kuhn. But, you know, Bowie Kuhn became commissioner in 69, still believing that the old ways of a Judge Landis still defined the position. He was the commissioner, he believed, of all of baseball, but much to his displeasure, Marvin Miller always pointed out that he was the commissioner hired by the owners, paid for by the owners, and at the core was an owner's man. Kuhn somehow refused to believe that. Now, talk about an antiquated idea. When once the owners elevated one of themselves to be commissioner in Bud Selig, no one pretends anymore that the commissioner isn't the owner's representative. So that's another archaic view. So those were the three main guys involved in the negotiations.
A large chunk of the book is obviously devoted to the strike. The season before and the season after make up the bulk of the book. But the perception was that during the strike, players were getting by. And I had a chuckle at what you wrote about Jack Clark complaining about making payments on his Rolls Royce and Jaguar. And you have other players who are working in bars and factories. And you tell a story of a pitcher for the Kansas City Royals who was working as a bartender when a tragic event took place. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so Rich Gale was, you know, kind of a solid middle-of-the-rotation starting pitcher for the Royals. In some ways, that 16th player that could be easily grabbed if the owner's free agent compensation plan had gone through. As you say, during the strike, there were varying degrees of players who, in terms of their wealth, right? So the rich guys got away pretty well during the strike. They kicked back, they spent time with their family. A guy like Rich Gale, while not poor relative to the economic structure of 1981, certainly had to work. So what he did was he became a bartender in Kansas City at the Hyatt. And because he wasn't a very skilled bartender, he was on the periphery of the action. And the action then was a tea time dance. It was a very popular event in Kansas City, the Hyatt was a brand new hotel. If people don't recall, there was a devastating accident, a structural accident at the Hyatt where the catwalks collapsed upon the 1,000 or so dancers, killing over 100 people, a real engineering disaster. That was a major story of that year. Rich Gale was on the scene, and as a Kansas City Royal, bartending at a Kansas City hotel, was something of a magnet for some people who, rather than be at the center of the dancing, would hang around to meet Rich Gale, get autographs. So Rich Gale's presence, which was due to the strike, actually ended up saving some people's lives, people who wanted to talk to Rich Gale as opposed to dancing. Rich Gale also was very much scarred by the incident because as he saw this devastation and screams of people in pain and dead bodies around him, he waded right into the action and tried to help people. It's a really sad story of the kind of commingling of the strike and a major event of that year.
What about some of the other players? Do you have stories of what they had to do for a living to get by until the strike ended?
Well, one of the funniest stories is I think a lot of baseball fans will remember Doc Medich as well as Richie Hebner. Hebner and Medich had been teammates on the Pirates in 76, I think. And Hebner was known for working in the offseason as a gravedigger. And Doc Medich was Doc for a reason. He went to medical school. He was a doctor. So one of the funniest lines was, during the break, Hebner, back to digging graves during the strike, said to Medich, you know, if you ever mess up, don't forget to give me a call. So I like that story. A lot of players, as you say, you know, they tended bar. Dave Stewart was working, you know, before Dave Stewart became the great Dave Stewart of the latter part of the decade for the A's. And Blue Jays, Dave Stewart was working like at a manufacturing plant. Other guys, you know, on the low end of the salary structure were working at sporting goods stores. But then there were guys like Hal McRae, who was just kind of kicking back and barbecuing with his family, and other players who had a bit more luxurious life and actually found themselves with something they'd never had since they were babies, the summer off. And they somewhat enjoyed it. I'm sure they were, you know, antsy to get back, but while they had some time, they spent it well.
Now, that's how it affected the players. What about the people who cover the players? How did this affect the media during that time?
There's a mad scramble nationwide to fill space, whether in newspapers or radio or TV. The first Saturday of the strike, NBC, instead of the game of the week, played Game 6 of the 1975 World Series. So that was easy. They had some footage. Newspapers started running old stories of historic games of whatever their local franchise was. There's also the rise of what was called then, and to some degree is still used in the same way, of fantasy baseball. The Padres, who were quite awful that year, ended up pretending to go on a long winning streak, and Jerry Coleman and Dave Campbell, as their announcers, would basically do not recreations, because they weren't real, but reimaginings of the games on the schedule. KMOX in St. Louis, this is one of my favorites, Jack Buck and Mike Shannon, who were the announcers, would do broadcasts of classic Cardinals games. So you had this funny situation of Mike Shannon, the announcer, commenting on Mike Shannon, the player, from the 1964 World Series or 1967 World Series. So as difficult as it was to fill space, I think a lot of people found ways to make it fun.
And how every ballpark has in its surrounding area, there are bars, there are restaurants, there are souvenir shops. What kind of impact did it have on those people?
It was a devastating time. I mean, people who really depended on the baseball crowds to eat at their restaurants, go to their bars, buy souvenirs, were really at a loss. More than anyone else, they kind of suffered directly and could never kind of reclaim that. The owners had strike insurance. The players, you know, had a temporarily halt temporary halt to their salaries, but the small business owners really suffered, particularly around places like you say, like Fenway Park, which has businesses right at the stadium. People like, you know, or businesses near Shea Stadium at the time, you know, were not truly near Shea Stadium, so they didn't depend directly on that crowd.
We often hear about baseball losing popularity over the last few years as a national sport. Now, you mentioned a news poll that indicated that 46% of respondents didn't miss baseball during the strike. Do you think anyone could look at 1981 and use that as the tipping point where baseball started to lose its popularity?
You know, I wouldn't necessarily agree to that. I think, you know, you and I as big baseball fans have read stories about the death of baseball that go back 100 years ago. You know, every 10 years there's a story about how baseball is over. I would almost argue the opposite, that the 81 strike, by the players preserving free agency, and with that, mobility of players, the ability for bad teams to have access to good players, increased competitive balance. The postseason participants for the rest of the 80s, including in the World Series, were as diverse, if I believe more diverse, than any era in history. Because of those things, it really led to, I think, an increase in the popularity of baseball in terms of attendance, national TV, marketing. But, you know, what's interesting about strikes, and they're kind of off the table, you know, it's funny that people who are not around our age have lived in a huge period of baseball peace. So the story of baseball strikes is somewhat old-fashioned. But it is very interesting when sports disappear that people kind of go on. I mean, there are degrees of rabid fans who can't survive without, you know, watching the Yankees or the Mets. But most people do kind of find that they can go on with their lives. And as we talked about the players, the guys who made their living off of this, they found a way to occupy a couple of months' time, and then they came back, and the fans did as well.
The 81 strike saw roughly 700 games lost during the 8-9 week period that there was no play. It wasn't obviously as long as the one in 1994. Now, Cal Ripken in 1995 was somewhat credited, at least a little bit, with saving the season because of his chase of the Gehrig record. Well, who were some of the sports-saving people, and what were some of the sports-saving moments in 1981?
In 81, you know, what's interesting about the 81 year, unlike 94, so 94, a strike hits during the season, and the season never resumes, and then the following year, the beginning of the season, is missing before they resume. But 81 had baseball, strike, and then baseball. So there were incredible storylines already in place before the strike. The biggest one was Fernando Valenzuela, the rise of Fernando Mania coming out of Los Angeles, the incredible national popularity that immediately happened as a result of Valenzuela's incredible pitching. He pitched 5 shutouts in his first 7 starts. That did resume after the strike ended. So, you know, it was centered on L.A., but road attendance really increased when Valenzuela was the starting pitcher. Pete Rose, one of the things I liked about writing this book was it's really hard to remember Pete Rose without infusing all the controversies. And certainly as mayor of Cooperstown, the Rose Hall of Fame controversy is always part of the discussion. But in watching Pete Rose pursue Stan Musial's all-time National League hit record, which he tied on the eve of the strike and broke the day after the strike, not the day after the strike ended, but the first day of play after the strike was settled. It was really quite wonderful to just encounter Pete Rose, the player, the joy he had in playing the game, the joy we had in watching, how much fun everybody had with him. It was nice to recapture that. So Pete was kind of a nice storyline before and after. The Yankees, you know, with George Steinbrenner at really his most George Steinbrenner-y, really kind of, you know, I think people don't remember what a, you know, kind of insane sadist he was. And people, certainly in the New York area, but nationally as well, were always galvanized by the insanity that surrounded the Yankees. And that year of the signing of Dave Winfield and Reggie Jackson's last year was just a fascinating psychodrama between Winfield, Jackson, and Steinbrenner. So there were a lot of good storylines.
Now, the Yankees made it to the World Series that year. Why was the decision made to split the season for the purposes of the playoffs instead of just having a cumulative record?
After the strike itself was settled, the players said the owners could decide what they wanted to do about the rest of the season. There was big ownership debate about how to proceed. One plan was, as you say, just resume the schedule. There would have been true and exciting pennant races that would have existed had they just resumed the schedule. But there was a thought by Kuhn that starting from scratch and creating new pennant races would certainly help maybe the teams that were out of contention in the first half by clearing the slate and letting them start 0-0 for the second half. There was also embedded in the national TV contracts the option to have an extra round of playoffs. So Kuhn felt, as did some of the owners, including Seelig, that having another level of playoffs would be good for TV ratings. What ended up happening was it was kind of an artistic disaster. You had the Cincinnati Reds with the best record in all of baseball not making the playoffs because they didn't win either half. You had the Cardinals in the NL East with the best record in that division for the whole year not making the playoffs. You had the Royals, who overall for the year were under 500, making the playoffs. And then when it came to the first round playoffs, the division series, the ratings were something of a disaster. Afterwards, NBC said we're not particularly interested in having another round of playoffs. So from the ownership side, it was a way they thought to increase attendance in the second half and increase TV ratings, and they got neither.
What's the takeaway here from your book?
Well, the takeaway, you know, that I have, and I hope people have, is, you know, there's an easy way to analyze salaries and labor issues. The players are greedy. End of story. That's not really how I view any of this. You know, I always find it ironic that people who are anti-player because of money issues are pro-owner. That's the oddest thing to me. The reality is, you know, particularly in 81, is that the players were fighting for a certain set of workplace rights, the same rights you and I have. If we want to pick up and work in our business anywhere in this country, we can. The players had recently gotten that right through free agency and didn't want to give that up. The players really felt, and I feel as well, that they were fighting a principled cause. And they prevailed. The owners, you know, are an erratic bunch who are just trying to claw back any gains in the game to preserve a power structure that had existed for most of the time. So I would love people to see, by reading about the labor negotiations, reading about the intelligence and the passion of the players who were involved in it, that there's a lot of depth to what the players have always pursued in labor negotiations, and if people can take that away from the book, I'll feel I've done a good job.
And the book is Split Season 1981, Fernando Mania, The Bronx Zoo, and The Strike That Saved Baseball by Jeff Katz. Jeff, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much, Ron.
And that was the Baseball Bookshelf Conversation with Mayor Jeff Katz of Cooperstown. Thank you for listening. Tune in again next time when our guest will be Chris Lucas, co-author with his father, Ed, of the new memoir, Seeing Home, The Ed Lucas Story, a blind broadcaster's story of overcoming life's greatest obstacles. And again, a reminder for the daily updates on the world of baseball books, please visit Ron Kaplan's baseballbookshelf.com and send your comments and suggestions to me at ronkaplan's baseballbookshelf@gmail.com. Thanks, everybody. See you next time.
He then said, boys, I'm glad I discovered this land.